First case for argument, United States versus Quincy and others, Mr. Bindi.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, David Bindi for the United States. This is the government's appeal from the decision of a district court to grant a motion to suppress evidence in which the district court found that although the transaction observed by the agents was suspicious, nevertheless, the suspicions did not rise to the level of probable cause, and so the arrest was illegal. The government's position is that there was probable cause for the arrest at the time that the agents acted for two reasons. First, the general fact pattern exhibited by this case is familiar. It is familiar to federal courts that deal with drug cases. The general pattern of meeting in a parking lot and relocating from there to an out-of-the-way location to exchange packages or bags is something that has been encountered in a number of drug cases, as we've cited in our brief. Second, the specific and particular facts of this case and the reasonable inferences to be drawn from them all point toward the conclusion that what happened here was a drug deal. And they
They were watching this building. They had a tip on this building. Does the record show how many people there were in the building, or?
Your Honor, I think the building was described as a multi-unit three-story building.
Just three stories, not a big apartment house.
I believe that's correct.
Could I ask you whether it's your position that Judge Shader, in a sense, made a legal mistake by discounting the officers' experience? I mean, they testified, do they not, that in light of their experience, this looked like, you know, what once we're at the Dominick's parking lot, beyond, this looked like an illegal transaction to them. Is it part of your argument that he just made a mistake there?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. This court and the Supreme Court have repeatedly recognized that the experience of the agents is a factor in making the probable cause determination. And our position is that Judge Shader, not necessarily that he took that entirely out of the equation, but that he gave it short shrift. He felt that the experience of the agents and their recognition of the fact pattern didn't significantly promote the government's position. We of course contend that it does, not just because this is something that is the kind of a fact pattern that's familiar to the agents, but also because it's familiar to the federal courts.
And you're willing to disregard all of this dispute about whether the brick was on top of the bag or on the seat or whether it was there at all, or
Judge Shader made an adverse factual finding,
right,
on that issue. The standard of review for findings of fact, particularly when based on an assessment of witness credibility, is insurmountable, and we did not ask or get permission from the Solicitor General to appeal that aspect of the district court's ruling.
So this is really just the conversation in the parking lot, the moving to the alley, the one car driving off, the intermediary exchanging the bags, and then she orders the arrest.
That is precisely correct, Your Honor.
Are you arguing this was a stop initially?
We argued that in the district court, that there was a sufficient basis for an investigatory detention here. But again, the district court made a finding that that this was not a Terry stop, and we're not appealing that ruling either. Our position is simply that what happened here was a drug deal, that all of the circumstances point, or the reasonable inferences from the facts and the circumstances.
Well, but if it was enough for a detention, it was enough for a stop, wasn't it?
If it was enough information to support an investigatory detention, yes, then that would have justified the seizure. But the problem with calling this an investigatory detention, Your Honor, is that the government's position below was that the reasonable suspicion ripened into probable cause rapidly, because as soon as Agent McCoy ran past Funch's car and looked in the passenger side window, she saw the brick in plain view. The district court's factual finding that the brick was not in plain view, that it was in fact concealed within the bag, necessarily means that the agents would have had to then enter the car and search the bag before they could have established probable cause for the arrest. And we're just not going down that route.
I thought you were also saying that, I mean, Terry stops aren't usually hurling somebody down the pavement immediately and handcuffing them, are they?
They're not usually, Your Honor.
That's the ones I think of.
They can be. A Terry stop can involve putting a suspect down on the ground and cuffing him, at least temporarily. Depends on how volatile the situation is and what the perceived threat is. The officers here believe this was a drug deal. It could have been a highly threatening situation, and their actions in rendering all three subjects prone before proceeding to the next step was certainly reasonable under the circumstances. But again, we're not contending that this was an investigatory detention that ripened into probable cause before too much time or too intrusive measures to gather information occurred. Our position is that there was probable cause at the time that the agents acted. Again, we stress that all of the circumstances and all of the inferences from the facts in this case point in the direction of a drug deal. All of the peculiar facts of this case are easily explained if you view this situation as a drug deal. They defy explanation if you try and look at it as any kind of an innocent transaction.
But you're not seriously arguing that there's some default rule that it must be a drug deal if you can't figure out what else it is. You used that term in your brief, which concerned me.
We used that term in our brief, Your Honor. The point of that argument is that when no innocent explanation is reasonable, when the agents...
Well, you don't have to go that far. You just have to say that the guilty explanation is substantially more plausible than the innocent, and therefore there was probable cause. It doesn't have to be proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
That essentially is our point, Your Honor, and especially because we make that comment in our brief in the context of stating that the standard for finding probable cause is less than a preponderance of the evidence.
I just wanted to make sure you weren't arguing that there was some default rule that you always assume it's bad if it can't be shown to be good, but if you've done the other first...
No,
it
comes in the context of what the standard of review is, and there simply are no reasonable inferences that can be drawn from the facts of this case that would point in any other direction than that it was a drug deal. We've raised the second issue in our brief regarding whether or not any of the defendants had a reasonable expectation in each other's cars.
If we were to find that your argument is correct with regard to expectations of privacy, what's the practical result with regard to the rest of the case?
Well, the practical result would be that the money that Funches handed over to Toro and Munoz, and which was found in Toro's car, would be admissible at a trial against Mr. Funches, but the drugs would not.
He's not contesting that, as I understood.
He's not contesting that. On the flip side, the drugs that were found in Funch's car would be admissible against Toro Munoz.
They are contesting.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Thank you,
Mr. Shim.
May it please the court. My name is Sam Shim on behalf of Mr. Toro and Mr. Munoz. As the government pointed out to this court, the only issue before it is whether or not the agents, at the time the arrest order was given, had probable cause to arrest the defendants in that alley. The findings of fact made by the district court indeed are not disputed by the government in this appeal, and we have to work with Judge Shader's findings of fact in determining whether or not he properly found that the agents did not have probable cause in this case. Indeed, indeed, Judge Shader found that there may have been suspicions at best, and he also found that it did not even rise to the level of reasonable suspicion.
Well, he didn't quite find that. But my concern about Judge Shader's finding is reflecting the question I asked Mr. Bindi, which is that he seems utterly to have disregarded the fact that the agents had seen patterns like this before, and that for people to go sneaking around to alleys and one person driving a minute away and coming back and exchanging bags and all of these things, he utterly discounts. I get the feeling that he was so annoyed with the government for having raised this issue of the Colombian guy 4 months earlier that their credibility was shattered, and he didn't want to listen to anything else they had to say.
Well, I don't think the district court completely disregarded the agents' collective experiences as agents working for the DEA and whatever experiences they may have accumulated in working in that field. I think the crux of his point was in first determining the credibility or the believability of Agent McCoy's testimony as to what she actually saw.
But that was later on. The government's content to rest on, I thought, facts that you agreed with, such as the meeting in the Dominick's parking lot, the conversation, the removal, and so on, up to the point where she says, whatever she says, let's move in, or there are certainly credibility findings he makes after that point, and whatever happens before may be not pertinent. But probable cause isn't, as Judge Posner just said, proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Why isn't this pattern enough to allow the agents to make the arrest?
Well, the collective experiences of drug agents is but one factor to be taken into consideration by a fact finder.
And they take the other factors into account, too. Where did it happen? What were the people doing? Why are they using an intermediary?
Right. Well, the government makes much of the fact, and they interpret it the way they want. When you reduce the fact of this case in its simplest and most relevant form, you have two Hispanic males that exit an apartment building, a multi-unit apartment building, that drive away, visit a pancake restaurant, visit a...
We know what happened. So
I'm trying to just zero in on this set of facts that everyone agrees happened and ask whether that, taken together, may not be as much as some of the facts in other cases where probable cause was found, but there's nothing in those cases that says we have now described the bare minimum. So our question is whether, even granting that what's here is somewhat less, whether it's nonetheless enough.
Well, our position is that based upon the case law, for example, in Grau, which this court decided, which is factually analogous to the facts of this case, that Judge Shader properly found that what the agents knew, what they had in their collective possession, was nothing more than reasonable suspicion.
But don't you think the government is correct that what counts as suspicion or probable cause depends on the alternatives? And ordinarily we'd say mere suspicion because, well, there were plenty of other explanations for why this person was... I mean, think of something like, we haven't seen them in a while, but these airport stops and they say, oh, this person was looking from side to side and looked nervous. Well, there are many alternative explanations. There are a lot of nervous people. But here, this strange exchange in the alley, what could it be? This business of exchanging rich Christmas gifts sounds really... Is that the best you or Judge Shader could come up with?
Well, that was one of the possible innocent explanations that was proffered by one of the parties in this case. But I think that Shader properly rejected the notion that was advanced by the government that somehow, unless a petitioner on a motion to suppress advances a reasonable, credible, innocent explanation.
Look, whenever you're trying to assess the truth of something, you're implicitly or explicitly you're considering the alternatives.
True.
What's more probable?
Well, I think Judge Shader, Your Honor, properly focused on what happened as far as the totality of the facts that...
Well, what do you think well, we know what happened with the drug deal, but can you imagine a similar situation, but that didn't involve, not necessarily drugs, but didn't involve some kind of criminal or other activity? Maybe something shady that isn't criminal? I mean, that would be innocent for these purposes.
Well, obviously, some type of an exchange occurred in this case, Judge. Whether we know it happened involved drugs. But perhaps
go into an alley? Now, you can imagine, well, the streets are crowded or something. You can't park, so they went into the alley. But I know... Seems to me, if you could think of it in terms of burden shifting, that if the government advances some argument based, as Judge Wood has stressed, on their experience as a pattern they've observed before, and then isn't there some burden on the defendant to say no, it could easily have been X or Y or Z, it didn't have to be a drug deal?
Well, I don't think it's reasonable, Justice Kovner, for us to always attribute some sort of nefarious activity to a certain set of conducts that always happen in an alley. Alleys were created for a reason other than to conduct illegal activities. And in this case, and by the way, it should be pointed out that it happened in broad daylight. If indeed it was, if they were to make out some sort of a nefarious implication by the mere fact that it happened in an alley, it negates their point. It happened in a broad daylight. It happened at wide open.
Look, there's a lot involved. They may be scared to meet up in the dark.
Well, that's true too, Judge. But the point is, when you consider the issue that's before this court, the standard review is whether or not Judge Shader was clearly erroneous in finding
underlying facts, but nobody's contesting them. In fact, it's de novo as to whether he was right on probable cause, the ultimate inquiry.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Shin. Mr. Miller?
May it please the Court? Your Honor, my name is Irving Miller. I represent Lorenzo Funches. If I could just correct a couple things, because I was trial counsel in this matter. Your Honor asked about the type of apartment building that was involved, and actual photos were introduced into evidence.
Mm-hmm.
This is a multi-unit, three-level apartment. The photograph, which is evidence, shows dozens of apartments that were in this particular building. This is not a three-flat. This is a large apartment building. Second of all, Your Honor, it was indicated that the government argued somehow that for Terry or investigatory detention before Judge Shader, absolutely not. The government specifically said on page 132 of the record, Judge Shader, this is a probable cause case. The
okay,
issue
we
is,
know that. We know that, yeah.
So I'm just trying to correct some matters we brought up before. Your Honors, as to what occurred in this alley, not only was there no probable cause, there was no reasonable suspicion that could have led even to a Terry stop. I cited in my brief several factors that would have negated probable cause, that would have negated reasonable suspicion, based upon any reasonable, objective police officer looking at this scenario. They go to the building. They know at the time of the building who the subject is. They have a picture of this Colombian dope dealer. It's not him. Second of all, Toro comes out of the building. They run the license plate. It comes back to that building. Thirdly, they go and travel to innocent places, a dry cleaners, a supermarket. Nothing in, occurring whatsoever. At some point in time, my client shows up. He's in a validly registered vehicle. Next, there's a conversation between Toro and my client in the Dominick's parking lot. It's not a two-minute conversation, okay, I'll give you $20,000 per kilo of drugs. It's a 30-minute conversation, according to the DEA agents, that occur in this Dominick's parking lot. Next, they drive to an alley. They don't go to a public place. They don't go to a Forest Preserve parking lot. They're in a public alley. But most importantly, they ran the license plate of my client's car. It came back validly registered. What they didn't know at the time was whether or not that car registered to an address on that alley. They had absolutely no idea. Did they take the time to do that? No. They go, they stop Mr. Funches' car, they put a gun to the window, they order him out of the car, he raises his hands, no furtive activity whatsoever up to that point in time. They order him face down on the cement in an alley and then search the car. Your Honor, those facts that these agents had, and it's not a subjective test as to what these agents believed in their heart of hearts at the time this was occurring. It's an objective test as to whether or not they had a reasonable belief that probable cause existed. And when you look in hindsight in your position as appellate court judges trying to determine whether or not probable cause existed, if you look at the record in this case and take into account what they say they saw and the factors that I set forth that they didn't see, that routinely agents come in and testify before finders of fact, furtive activity.
What should they have thought was going on in the alley?
Can I give your honors an example of what could have occurred? It's a short example. I sat in a domestic relations courtroom last week, and my client was ordered out of his house by a judge in domestic violence court. An order of protection was issued against my client, that he could not go within 1,000 feet of his home. An order was also entered that an intermediary had to go pick up the property, his personal belongings, from the wife, bring them out of the house, and give them to my client because he was not allowed to go in there. And I was sitting in court and I said, well, if I remember asked what the reasonable expectation was of what could have occurred, this is an exact fact pattern that could have occurred because orders of protection are issued, hundreds of them issued on a daily basis. Now, I don't mean to insult your intelligence at all by giving you an example of what could occur because you know what did happen in this case. But this was a fortuitous chance that these agents came upon a drug deal. What if it had been an exchange of a Marshall Fields bag for a Nordstrom bag, and that's all that was occurring? What if an innocent citizen doing absolutely nothing but exchanging items with his neighbor occurred? My father was a butcher. We had a neighbor who was a baker. They routinely traded goods between one another. Your Honor, there is no basis whatsoever for these agents to have believed that a dope deal was occurring in this alley. And what occurred to Lorenzo Funches could happen to any American citizen based upon an exchange of bags in an alley. And I certainly hope that there is no such concept as probable cause by default. And my only other statement is, when is a defendant supposed to give his innocent explanation? Is it after he's already on the ground with a gun to his head? Is that when the innocent explanation theory is supposed to occur? Or is it a year later when we stand before a court of appeals? A defendant did not give Lorenzo Funches a chance to offer an innocent explanation. They could have, upon stopping the car.
I understand. There was a suppression hearing.
No, my question, when is a defendant supposed to voice to law enforcement?
At a suppression hearing.
But that's not what the government is contending, Your Honor. They're saying that the defendant has to come up with an innocent explanation. And I'm saying to you,
I don't understand you. It's a question of what kind of inference can be drawn at a suppression hearing when the circumstances are suspicious and no alternative innocent explanation for the circumstances is offered.
And what I'm saying to you is there is no such requirement in the law. There's no statutory.
It's not a question of requirement in the law. It's just a question of common sense. If you're trying to decide, why was the person walking down a corridor at O'Hare with a machine gun strapped to his wrist, right? Yeah, maybe he was an officer or something, right? But if he wasn't, you'd say this was suspicious behavior.
And my only comment, Judge, is when did the defendant himself, by his own person, does he verbally express it in his explanation? These agents didn't give Lorenzo Funches the chance.
You're missing the point completely. The question is not what he's supposed to say when he's arrested. The point is, when the question is the legality of the arrest, does he have any obligation to offer an innocent explanation for circumstances which otherwise seem suspicious?
My answer is, respectfully, no, he does not. It is the government's burden to show probable cause. It's not the defendant's burden to show
that
probable
cause. Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Bindi, how much time does he have? 2 minutes?
If there is no reasonable explanation, reasonable innocent explanation for the behavior witnessed by the officers that is at least as likely to be true as the explanation that it was a drug deal.
But Mr. Miller suggests maybe it was somebody under a protection order is it your feeling then that the DEA agents in those cases just should wait for the Bivens suit? Because obviously there's never a suppression hearing if it is a guy who's just, you know, getting his shoes from the house he's had to vacate.
Well,
you know, we never get to the point of the suppression hearing, right?
I don't think that even constitutes a reasonable explanation or something that would have been reasonable for the officers to infer, Your Honor. The defendants in this case went out of their way to conduct this transaction in an alley. And when people go out of their way to do their business in an alley, their business belongs in an alley, or at least probably so, and that's probable cause. Now, there is no reasonable alternative explanation for what they were doing, and that's why there was probable cause, given the standard for what's necessary to find probable cause, less than a preponderance. There's probable cause in this case. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much to both.